Well, I want to do another reality thing in a second, but I just wanted to say to the, anyone in the audience, that feel free to contribute, ask a question, or share a thought about anything that's come up for you about the play. Maybe something that we haven't discussed yet that you'd like to see discussed. But while you're thinking about that, one of the things that interested me about the play was that you didn't seem to have a hero or a villain in the conventional media portrayal of abusive relationships, or relationships where abuse or violence appears to be happening. And if you go back to the media portrayal of the Austrian situation and all these Stockholm Syndrome type situations where someone has been held captive for a long time or is in a relationship where abuse appears to be occurring, the media feels there has to be a hero and a villain. Your portrayal captures, I think, the psychoanalytical view, which is often it's not so clear-cut, and there's collusion between the abuser and the abused. I mean, what were your thoughts about that? Was that something you were aware of?
I think very much aware. I think you have to be very careful. It was a decision quite early on for Carly to be the violent partner, and the minute we made that decision, then there's a whole new kind of area of risk that you're falling into, because people like the Hindley case, for example, women who are seen as anything that's kind of considered as evil and enacted by women immediately becomes very, very sensational for people to get their head around. So I think that there's a bigger risk for a performance piece that presents a violent woman. So I think we were very kind of not cautious, but I think it was something we knew we were taking on board, something that could be done very badly. And so it's not that we would have made it any less complex or any less understandable for our audience. In some ways, we liked the pressure that even because when we read the script, it's one thing, but it's when you finally get your piece in front of you. I can remember the last kind of few runs of the show in the rehearsal room before it went out on tour, and it really was just thinking, does it sensationalise in the way that we were afraid of, in terms of it being a female, the female character who is the one that seems to be violent? I think we have to be very careful.
Yeah. I think certainly a collusion in that it's a mixture of personalities. And if it was the man beating up the woman, if it was just seen as someone's force, physical force against another, I think it dilutes the whole situation, because it's actually it's control, mental control, and that's the thing that hurts. But it takes two to tango, as it were. There is a collusion of this connection, these personalities. You know, they come together, and there's no accident in their names either. Although it's a little bit of a joke on Bryony's part, you know, Todd and Carly, death and destruction. I mean, we didn't want to be on the nose. That's her kind of just having a little joke. But Stockholm, just so we didn't want to be on the nose with that, we're taking a risk. If we'd have said the show was called Stockholm Syndrome, you go, I know what's going to happen. And we didn't want that. So even though we did flirt with the name Stockholm, we quickly tried to sideline that. Within the first scene, he starts talking about, we're going to Stockholm. That's where we're going to go. So even Stockholm Syndrome is a place that's over there. It's not here. That's what they're saying. Stockholm Syndrome doesn't live here. It's over there. And we're not there yet. We're going tomorrow. So on many levels, there's a denial of their situation, but also we wanted to play with your mind so that it was as open as possible to this relationship, because I think things can close down very quickly.
There was a brilliant response in Leeds last year after the show, and this girl really loudly went, I don't get it. They never even went to Stockholm.
I really want to hear.
I suppose I was first struck that nobody's used the word, two words, which I think we should think about, was, of course, the sadomasochism. Nobody's mentioned that whole dynamic in relationship. And the other word I thought was idealisation, because actually one of the things I thought could be a danger was to idealise, as they do, the relationship that could be, which is what couples do all the time, so perfect. I keep thinking of that framed photograph. You know, the first photograph was when they very first met, and she said, we blew it up, it was a little Polaroid, and we made it larger than life, didn't they? Which is what their relationship felt. And I suppose two things, really, thinking analytically about the dangers of idealisation, because where else could it go but down and denigrated? But the dangers of the play in that relationship, because it was so erotic as well, of that becoming rather idealised, that that would be the way to have great sex, or with the violence, you know, that, I suppose, the eroticism of sadomasochism. Anyway.
I don't think they have violent sex.
Yeah.
They have a metaphorical erotic encounter over a dinner, which is played out as sex with knives and forks, which actually just came from the line "food arrived at some point," and the idea that we loved, the idea that they love each other to bits, they devour each other, you know, from that kind of terminology. I think their idealization of their relationship, I always thought that might actually unnerve an audience rather than sweep the audience along forever. We like the idea that they go with them, but then start to go, that's not right. And be very kind of subtle about it. Things like the photograph is a framed photograph. She had it blown up to the exclusion of everybody else who was in that photograph. And she says that's the day that they became us. So not individuals, us. It's so tightly packed in. It is being sold through love. She's saying it's a wonderful thing. But I don't know whether... I don't know, maybe I'm misreading you, thinking that it's an accusation of idealising them. I think what they do is horrible.
But I think you share... I think what comes across is the fragility of idealisation, because they're constantly having to sort of create it. I mean, even the photograph. And the fact that they've got to have this photograph, something sort of in print that kind of, you know, confirms them as this ideal couple. And they have to keep doing things in order to sort of keep recreating this idea that they are, you know, this perfect couple, which just shows how fragile it is.
There's a lot of maintenance in the show. I mean, you see when she's on the internet and she's... I mean, that trip to Stockholm is going to be planned within an inch of its life by the sound of things. She's got it all. I mean, she hasn't planned it, but she knows exactly where the massages are.
Know the name of the travel agent.
She doesn't know the important bit she doesn't quite get. But I think there's something about that I think it's important that the audience understands that there is an ideal that they're upholding. And I think what's important for us as an audience is to realise how exhausting that is, because she cannot maintain that. And what she's doing in trying to maintain it is to control every element. So even this excursion to Stockholm, there's nothing liberating about that for them, and she'll make sure that it isn't, and she will be able to tell him exactly where he is and when. But I agree. I think we do present it as them creating the ideal, but we see the kind of the fact that it couldn't ever be as successful as she would like it to be.
There's another contribution from the audience. Could we get as many people in as possible just to come back to this point?
Yeah, just one of the I want to come back to something slightly earlier, which is sort of, sometimes you were talking, and I think it's the play that does that, as about the borderline personality, and sometimes it's the borderline couple. And I think that one of the strengths of the play was that actually I didn't think of it, or the strength of it for me was that I didn't think of it as being about one person being the abusive one and the other not, though obviously I can think of it that way. It was actually a mutually abusive relationship, or a mutually abusive couple, and that they were stuck in that. And I didn't think that one was doing it and the other wasn't. And I think the word collusion doesn't quite get the strength of, as it were, not just playing along, but both of them moving together in a sort of like a dance, which they have a sort of choreography where they always do this and then get over and then they start again or whatever. So and I think that's a strength, because the typical thing about domestic violence is that one does it and the other receives it. And in a sense, that's highly predictable. And, you know, and it's not that it's untrue, but it's less interesting than this sort of... it's the couple that is borderline, and we don't know what they would do with other people. That's what's quite interesting, that we don't know what would happen if the woman, Carly, happened to be with somebody else quite different. We don't know what the man would do if he were with somebody quite different. And it's possible that they both might be in a much better state. not because they wouldn't necessarily carry what they do in the couple to everywhere else. They might do, but it is left completely open in my mind as to what would happen.
I think that's,
and
right.
I think that's very good.
We did actually talk about that. All of us that had experience of those kind of relationships didn't necessarily have another one straight away, and couldn't quite understand it once we got apart from it. And I was going to say something else really brilliant, and I've forgotten it.
There's another thought from the audience that just gets...
I think it's a really interesting meeting of form and content, because I'm coming at it from a theatre background, and the performers who were playing Todd and Carly enacting that violent scene had to work so closely together as actors to make it happen and make it so believable in the violence of two people who weren't together. And I just found that really interesting, kind of listening to your perspectives on it, that as a performer they had to be so tight to do that.
I think that completely and much better describes what we're trying to struggle with from a psychoanalytic point of view to put into words, because I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it links to your point, and I think your point links to your point about ideal, because it seems to me that if you create a space where you exclude the opposite of ideal, whatever that is, the bad, the awful, you create an illusion which has to be worked at absolutely meticulously to maintain it. And there is no mechanism for getting away from that. I mean, in a different setting, like in a residential establishment, there is always splitting going on. Anybody who works with sort of patient young people particularly will describe splitting, okay? And very often what that means is one member of staff is being hated and getting all the shit, and everybody thinks this is the poor member of staff who's being attacked by a particular patient or whatever. And the other people are being very helpful and saying, you know, why don't you try, you know, being standing up to them or whatever? And they all feel they're not being attacked. But actually, the people who are being attacked are the ones who are being idealised. Because really, if they could be absolutely honest, they would have to admit that they are terrified of being in the position of the person who's getting the shit. The person who's getting the shit knows that she's not bad, knows that it isn't true, and has a capacity to move. And for me, you kind of understand that when you think about what idealization is, which is that it's being put on a pedestal. You know? How much movement do I have on this pedestal? The moment that I take a step, you know, I fall flat on my face. And that, in a couple, has to be worked at, exactly what you're saying. That idealization has to be worked at in order to keep everything bad out there. I mean, that links a bit, I think, to your sadomasochistic thing, but I'll get boring if I keep talking, so I'm going to shut up.
I have a question. I haven't seen the play about the line remorse, true remorse, and how that applies. And that,
sorry, can you speak up a bit?
I said I had a question about remorse because I haven't seen the play. And if in situations when somebody says, I'm sorry, or they've been violent, but they do it again, yeah. Or the classic situation of buying flowers and true remorse is not doing it again and saying sorry. So I don't understand how that applies in the play. What happens with remorse?
Yeah, I mean, I can only say it's a terribly powerful moment in the play, and it sort of follows the violent sort of scene or dance, however you want to see it, but anyway, the violence. And Carly sort of crumbles, really, doesn't she? And she's sort of in pieces on the kitchen floor and saying that she's terribly sorry, it's her fault, she'll get help. And at that point, Todd feels very sort of moved and... You know, when she's really feeling it, he feels very sort of connected with her, doesn't he? And he approaches her, and it's at that point that they kind of connect in this really powerful way again. But I think it is a good question, because
how real is the remorse when somebody apologises? Are they doing it to get something from the other person? And how seriously can the other person take it?
I think we were very aware of that, and we asked her in the rehearsal room, she had to say sorry. But we had to say, look, we want you to say sorry, but for it to never just sound like sorry, it's got to come from somewhere that he's never heard. So if it comes out like a bark, that's fine. First of all, you've got to get his attention, that he's never heard that noise before. And so this weird kind of attempt to say sorry came out, and he's drawn to it. And they have a moment where she's just a mess, and she just looks at him and then tries not to look at him. And he knows then that it's real. And then he says, there's absolutely no way of telling anybody on the outside of this how attractive it is. Mm. True remorse, because it is real. She means it from the bottom of her heart. The key to that is there's no way of telling anybody on the outside of this.
Mm.
You. Yeah, because he's invited us in to this moment. He's even shown us what she is and says she does this, that and the other, and it's over. But in this moment, he suddenly just goes, he slams the door. He does what my friends did in way back. And that was the key moment for us. It hasn't become a discussion anymore. He's making a point. You won't get this. You won't understand it. You don't understand it. Does that? So it's a very personal reaction.
I want to pick up on your point, but at the risk of sounding like a cosmopolitan agony aunt, what you're saying is very interesting in terms of the psychological understanding of abusive relationships where the man hits the woman and then says, I'm sorry. Yes. And the way you asked that question was about, you know, does he really mean it? What does it mean in terms of sorry? Now, what that, at the risk of sounding sexist, some psychologists would say is a particularly feminine approach, which is, does he really mean it? The man would say, well, if he hits me again, then I know he doesn't mean it. I don't have to try and get inside his head to find out what's going on, which is what the feminine approach is. Let me try and find out what's going on. Whereas the behaviourist would say, let's just observe the behaviour. He says he's sorry, then he hits you again the next day or a week later, then he says he's sorry, then he hits you again. Why are you asking the question, what does it mean? I mean, because it would be complicated for him what he means. He may feel genuine remorse at that moment.
But do you know, I don't think it's about her saying that she's sorry. I think it's about something that's going on in this couple, because there is this question, isn't there, about why is he with her? Why is he with this violent woman? And, of course, there's what they share together, which is they get into this state where they feel in this sort of wonderful kind of merged fused sort of perfect couple state, and that's very exciting and intense and everything. But there's also something, I think, about how vulnerable she is, actually, behind the violence. And I think at that moment she is incredibly vulnerable, and it really... It kind of turns him on, I think.
I think so.
I think, it's like intense. He's got this the most intense feeling he has in the whole play. And after that, they do go to bed and have lovely sex, And I think there's something about her vulnerability, because you've got to ask the question, why? Why do these couples stay together? And so I don't think it's actually so much the words and, because you can say, well, she doesn't really mean it, and we all know it's going to happen again and everything, But she certainly is, and what is true and what he knows to be true is that she feels intensely bad and vulnerable, and she's wrong and everything at that point, and he finds that incredibly attractive.
I think what's interesting just hearing you say that is I just remember how we directed that moment with Sam, because I think it is the most empowering moment that his character has, but also it's also one of the most uncontrollable moments that he has. Because on any given night in the performance, Sam will sometimes, it'll make him cry or it'll make him laugh, the actual moment and the line. Mm. And we've never, ever told him to stick to one or the other, because I think the truth of that moment is that it's suddenly, it's this massive release in him, Tom the character, and as a consequence, Sam as an actor, that it does feel like it's just something that doesn't have a... It's something outside our control as directors to ask him to nail that moment precisely.
Although there is something we did tell him to stick to, and that's... we noticed it in rehearsals one time when he was kind of hugging her, and he kind of went in, and he just got really low, and it became about him being hugged. And we thought, no, that's not right. So he said that when he's hugging her, what he actually does at one point... is just do that. He hugs her, but puts his arm across her, and it became the most protective moment. He really kind of claimed this as their own. So even though whether he's laughing or crying, he's... Again, back to the metaphor of slamming the door, I think.
There was another contribution.
Well, I was going to suggest the term regression is what happened to that moment, that she regresses, and there's something about the kind of... I mean, the term narcissistic couple... kept coming to my mind, and that somehow the narcissism is put to one side, and there's a regression, perhaps to an earlier stage of development, and that explains something about the release. But it doesn't last, because without the adult personality, there isn't the kind of organisation to get them through life. So
I want to pick up on that. So one of the words you use, narcissism, which is a very popular term in psychoanalysis, but there's a notion that we're living in a particularly narcissistic age. What do you think about the idea of this couple as a narcissistic couple?
I think they love their own image. Yeah. They love the image of the couple, certainly. Every aspect of the set was built to present that. And I think, pretty much by accident, but I think we'll claim it as our own now, when she smashes her face into the water... Actually, it's in the writing. When she smashes her face into the water, what she's left with is this rippled reflection. It's her reflection in the water. And the face is contorted. The image is completely broken for a while. But that speech that she says then is all about self-loathing. So I think there's certainly narcissism in this world. Because all she can see is the couple, all she wants to see is the couple. She can't use the telescope that he bought her. She can't look out of the window. She can't see to the distant horizon. There's nothing apart from this image.
Psychoanalysis sort of adds something, or has a slightly different take on narcissism. But I think this couple are narcissistic in both senses, in the sense that you've described, and also in the more psychoanalytic sense, which is it's more to do with this couple who can't really see the other one as a separate person and their own, you know, the separate reality of the other one, and sees the other person the way they want to see them, kind of, you know, to fit into some, you know, some projective aspect of themselves, really, which, you know, I think you can see with Todd and Carly too.
And the use of the language, the amount of times they say they,
yes,
when they're talking about
the
couple.
That was interesting. That the way that... you know, it was often them. It was nearly all the time, actually, wasn't
they
it?
They never say I.
No,
no,
that's right.
Yeah.
There's another.
Yeah, it was that point that is something that I really took away from the production, is the use of the third person, and how, as an audience member, I was unsure as to the perspective they have on the concept of they, because they talk about they don't talk about I or we or us, and I just found it really interesting because it. One and the same time, I was really drawn to them as a couple, and, you know, wanted to be them with this wonderful life and the six pack, and that, but felt really apart from it as well. I just thought it was a really interesting choice to do that because of distancing and not.
I think we quite like the idea that they felt they could comment on their life and they understood their life. It goes back to our understanding of Stockholm syndrome as you don't self-diagnose. With Stockholm syndrome, you think you understand that relationship, and we really wanted them to think that they understood their relationship. If that makes sense,
I think that's it is important, that point, actually, because it does seem to me, in terms of thinking about the narcissistic couple, and also I want to get back to Ruth's point about regression, that the couple who can operate in an adult way, as an adult couple, where there can be reality, I think, and Mary and I both think it's a theory we've developed together, so we'll share it with you this evening. We have this idea that there is, that makes a couple work, that there is an idea of ourselves as a couple that we share, which allows us to be individuals and allows us to have... the capacity to tolerate our separateness, because we have an idea of us as being a couple. But this couple, I don't think, have that kind of idea of themselves as a couple. I think they have exactly what you were saying about the kind of mirror thing. They have an idea of a couple that they have to fit to. And it's again this ideal thing where they're fitting to an idea of a couple, and then they are looking to an audience, an imagined audience, which is why they use the they, constantly to be affirming that they are absolutely right as this couple. And it completely, although it uses the same sort of imagery, it's completely denying the possibility of difference. It's a mechanism for denying difference. And it does seem to me that your point about regression, the point at which Todd could leave is the point after the violence. He could say, I'm fed up with this, I'm not having it anymore. And when she does this thing, which I believe is completely genuine, because I think she's completely bereft, suddenly, absolutely, totally lost and totally remorseful about that, it is, as you said, an incredibly erotic moment. And it just draws you in. But it draws you in at the same level that your baby draws you in, you know, and that you want to eat. I mean, both my children, one of them's in the audience, I wanted to eat him when he was little. You know, it's that, oh, God, you're just so...
you up, yeah.
And you lose, again, any capacity to be outside and thinking about yourself, and you're back in it again, you're swamped.
That moment you described where her vulnerability, she's been angry and dangerous, and then she collapses, at that moment as being a turn-on to the person, is an idea which is difficult and unacceptable to many people, that could happen to us. And isn't one of the things psychoanalysis is about, trying to make the dark, unacceptable stuff? Psychoanalysis creates a language whereby we can speak about it or try to talk about it. Do you think there's been any progress in that in the 100 or so years since the term was coined, in terms of a public discourse about unacceptable stuff, that we can harbour homicidal feelings or we can get turned on by stuff that we'd rather not admit to?
Well, that's a nice little question to throw at us, isn't it?
And what about the theatre?
What do you think?
Has theatre made any progress in making the unacceptable dark stuff that we don't talk about openly part of public discourse?
I think very much so. I think Britain in particular, I think new writing, which is a fairly modern phenomenon, I think writers like Sarah Kane were incredible in terms of tapping into that kind of world. I think she only wrote 4 or 5 plays, but I think all of them caused a lot of problems for people. And I think there's something about the accuracy of her writing which was the problem. It wasn't about it wasn't necessarily the themes. I think it was her capacity to nail the emotionally desperate states. And I think it was then about very, very accomplished directors, most of them at the Royal Court, who then presented this really complicated language and kind of, in a weird way, made something palatable to an audience, but you didn't like the taste of it when you were watching it.
So is there an audience for this kind of stuff?
There really is. Yeah, it's probably a very strict demographic, I'd imagine. But Sarah Kane's plays were selling out the Royal Court night after night. So yeah, okay. There is.
It's massive in Europe. Yeah, incredible. One of the biggest exports. Mark Ravenhill and Sarah Kane are both enormous throughout Europe.
I just thought of a way of answering your question apart from just collapsing, which was tempting, which is that the business at the moment that is preoccupying us all is terrorism. And I think that this analysis that we have developed in just a very short time of how somebody can end up being a suicide bomber is only possible because there's already the capacity to look at those parts of ourselves. Because, you know, the wish, the desire is to say somebody else is a suicide bomber. Somebody who's a Muslim or some kind of fanatic somewhere else is a suicide bomber. And what this country has come to terms with very quickly is the idea that actually what makes somebody a suicide bomber is a process that we all go through called adolescence, for instance, where we are really open to things inside us and frightened by those things inside us, and where if the right person comes along at that right time and provides us with a mechanism for getting out of the awfulness, we will take it. Now, I don't think people could easily have thought about that before Freud came along and gave us a language to think about that, so I do think that makes a difference. Look at that. People are responding to that.
Which is that I was thinking that in a way, I was looking for another... made me think of another possible version of the play. And the other... because in a way, you could say that Carly is the suicide bomber, and that's, you know, full of violence, whatever, and terribly vulnerable and not managing to cope with it and all the rest of it, and he's sort of rather collusive with it, or whatever. And that's the thing. But you could also say one of the things that I'm concerned with is state terrorism and the borderline personality in us, which enables us to be totally collusive with an ongoing war in Iraq, to come in Iran, the Palestinians, and all the rest of it. And we go along with that, mostly, and bombers go out from Britain and the United States, from airfields, over and over, bombing right, left, and centre, killing vast quantities, millions, actually, and... in a sense, there's a psychopathology of a borderline personality which could be addressed, in a sense, much more creatively. And, in a sense, what that made me think of was the play. that it would be very interesting to do a version of the play in which the greatest violence, somehow or other, was done by the man. And that somehow, as it were, the overt violence of Kali could be seen in this new version as a response to a covert, provocative sort of reign of something or other from the man, which would be much harder to detect. Just as, so we always talk about the terrorist and the mind of the terrorist, but not about the mind of the dominant circles in Britain and America and so on. And if we just, I just saw a sort of analogy between the two. What do we do about the psychopathology of the rulers of the world of which we are one?
And one of the things that the borderline personality is about the fact they enjoy rage, or they enjoy that sense of destruction, and how much that is all within us, in terms of the fact that there's something about us that seems to enjoy destruction or rage, the expression of rage, so that rulers can conjure it up out of us easily in order to sell a war, for example. And there was a question or a thought behind it.
Yeah, I had a question for both of the couples, actually, on this point of where this comes from. I wondered how much you guys explored the biography and the life history of the couple and what might have happened to them in adolescence or in their family that led them to find themselves in this type of relationship. And then I wondered how the psychoanalysts, the questions that they would be asking about that of a couple like this if they were working with them. What would you be looking to in their histories, their life histories, their family biographies? Where would you be looking for clues as to why they ended up there?
Very interesting question. Do you want to go first?
Our initial exploration was very much in the moment, how this couple operated in the moment. And out of that exploration, the text was developed. And to be quite honest, there were discussions about what might have been, but most of it is actually just about taking what we know from the text. So not too much kind of wild fantasy or going too far back. There are little clues within the text. The way Kali spits out the word, fucking families. You know, and that, okay, great, yes. Okay, so she doesn't like families. It's something that she is going to push on to Todd. You know, we're both going to reject families, aren't we? You know, that suggests a history, but we only ever wanted to suggest. Do you know what I mean? We didn't ask our performers to go into great detail, and certainly not ski off piste, to actually take what they could find within the script.
And isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Because, you see, we would do the same. I would be absolutely that's not true, I'm uninterested. I mean, I'm sort of vaguely interested in where it all came from. But I'm much more interested in what's going on in the room now. That really, genuinely, is what I'm interested in. And patients will say to me, but why? And want me to get involved in working out with them where it all came from. And it's the patients who are really interested in where it all came from. I'm interested in what's going on now. And what I've discovered is that if I focus on what's going on now, eventually they'll tell me where it all came from, which is vaguely interesting. But, you know, I mean, it reinforces an idea. But, of course, it is an assumption that people make, isn't it, about psychoanalysis, that what we're doing is reconstructing something, and that somehow by reconstructing it, that's what makes it all better. And I don't think that's true. I think it is true that things begin very early on, you know, and I can talk theoretically about this until the cows come home, as you can imagine. But it's not so in the work, that's not what I'm doing. It really isn't. I'm just trying to understand what's happening in the room now and describe that and see if we can understand a bit more about that.
Well, I'm just so struck by what you just said, because it seems to me that even though you're saying that what interests you is what's happening there in the room in the present, and you're less interested in the backstory, well, on the one hand, you do say that eventually the people in the room will come up with the backstory, hopefully because they're starting to make connections between what they're doing in the present and what the roots are. But I'm a little bit surprised, if I'm understanding you correctly, at your seeming to kind of devalue the importance of looking at the roots of the behavior, because it seems to me that so often if one is in a destructive relationship, it tends to have more to do with something that happened in the past because of what you were talking about earlier about, and I can't remember the language you used, but that the sort of parent-child relationship that we all carry within us, and if it's an unhealthy one, then that is the source for being recreating it in adult life. Okay. And wouldn't it be important to say, I don't have to be obsessed with this person. It's not about this person. It's about an issue within me that needs to be resolved, which no one else can resolve for me, that it has nothing to do with the other person.
Okay, that's terribly helpful. I'll give you an example of a general case, okay, that is why I work the way I do and not the way that people think I should do. An awful lot of patients have a grievance, okay? They come with a grievance. Now, the difference for me between a grievance and a complaint is a very simple difference, which is a complaint is the kind of thing that Mary encourages me to get better at doing, which is going back to the supermarket with the bottle and saying, there's something wrong with this bottle. And I know that it's going to be awfully embarrassing, and Mary knows that they'll say, oh, sorry, yes, here we are, and then I come away again. That's a complaint. You know, that's a complaint, and you're hopeful that something will be resolved. But a grievance is something you hold on to, and there's no way you're going to let it go. Now, that grievance will have begun very, very early on, and that grievance will be about, say, for instance, a grievance with a father who was deserted me when I needed a father, or whatever it may be, okay? So I'm holding this fucking grievance, right? But the way that the grievance will show is in the relationship, in the analytic relationship. And only if I can comment about how it's being used now might it be possible to begin to let it go. You are using this grievance. You need to be angry with me. Because if you let go of your anger with me, you don't know what might happen between us. Now, then the patient begins to think, I'm with a person who might be able to manage what will happen between us if I let go of this grievance. And then they begin to let go of the grievance. So if I say to them, you've been angry with your mother all this time, and if only you could stop being angry with your mother, you'll feel much better. They say, fuck off. They won't do it. You know, there's no reason to do it because there's nothing alive in the moment that makes them want to do it. Whereas it might actually make a difference just for a minute to have a little go with this guy who seems to say, I can manage you not, you know, but you're, what would it be like?
You That's know, I may have explained myself a little bit wrong because I was talking about if in the room was the couple. Because, and I totally get what you mean about, you know, that, in other words, the thing from the past has to be recreated in the present to get to the other side. Mm. But if the therapist is watching the couple interact a certain way and can say to either member of the couple, your grievance is not really with your partner. You can choose to be with that person or not be with that person, but you're keeping alive a dynamic from the past.
I quite see where you're coming from, but I would just put it differently. I would say, and let them make the link that it's to do with the past, I would say this is a very comfortable situation.
This is something you know.
This is something you know. Right. You like to be here. You know where you are. You're with a bastard who you know has made your life miserable. And that, because that allows people to, and then they have a moment to think about it. Whereas if you say, you're just choosing
about
your mother.
I just think it's which way you kind of do it. And I think, you know, I was just thinking, I was with a couple today who were talking about a difficult situation where one of them was going to be going away for 9 days, and this is always a problem for them, you know, when they're apart, and this is all going to happen, and I'm going to be away as well at the same time. And we kind of explored that first, and then, you know, she started saying, this is what it was like for me, you know, when I was sent off to school when I was, you know, 7 years old or whatever, and, you know, and she started making the links with the history herself. And I just think it's, and patients often do, you know, if they start to really understand something in the present. And I just think that I think a lot of people, I mean, people, psychoanalysts and therapists have different approaches to this. You know, this is just one version of it. And I think history is important, actually, for all psychoanalysts, even this one. But but I think that, you know, it can be rather sort of dry and meaningless just to sort of make, you know, it's much more important, much more therapeutic if the patient can make those links in a meaningful way themselves, really. That's all.
I'm going to do a reality thing, I'm afraid, because we're rushing towards the end, because we have to end on time. I'm going to close with a question to the two couples here. And it arises out of the issue brought up with by idealisation. And I'm going to stick up a bit for idealisation, because there's a very interesting recent psychology experiment done where they take couples and they take a photograph of both of you, and they digitally manipulate the picture so they can make the picture a lot more physically attractive than you actually are in reality. And they can also manipulate it so you're uglier than you are in reality. And they can put different pictures up on the wall of gradations towards reality and then to better than reality. And they ask people to spot which of the pictures is actually the true image of your partner. Okay, now what's really interesting is it couples who are getting on well, and of course the psychoanalyst will be suspicious of that, but the couples who are getting on well and are happy, and say they're happy in their relationship, they pick a picture which isn't actually the real picture of you. They pick one which has been manipulated to be slightly more attractive than the real you. And they think that's the real picture of their partner, but actually they're picking a more idealised version of their partner than is the truth. When you pick couples who not getting on well or are unhappy with each other, they pick a picture which is uglier than the true you. Now, the theory about this is that we need to idealise our partners. We need to think we're the more attractive person we really are in order for the relationship to survive in the long run. In other words, true reality does not keep a relationship going. You need a bit of idealisation. So my question to both of you is a bit about that, what your thoughts are about that. But some people say that the play has a very dark view of human nature at the end. If it was an American Hollywood movie, it would end in a slightly more upbeat way than it does. What are your thoughts about your view on human nature, as perhaps expressed by that or not expressed by the play? I mean, are you optimistic about relationships and couples, or are you pessimistic?
Well, I think, as friends of Todd and Carly, which we've always considered ourselves, because, you know, we were invited in, they talk to us, I think it's very depressing that they deny their situation and that their behaviour appears to be cyclical. But the most depressing thing in the play, I think, is the potential future expressed by us at the end. Because what we found, and we're very keen to express, was that this isn't just cyclical behaviour. I think that's too easy, too glib. For a while it's cyclical, but there's always the potential for it to stop being cyclical when you can't have that impact on the partner that you need. They aren't listening to you in the way that you want, and they're looking out the window. So what do? You kill the kids. I know it's a horrible leap, but Bryony really wanted to talk about the potential. And she, because that was the other thing we researched, was couples who apparently inexplicably took their kids to the top of an apartment and jumped off, or in Southall, a woman who took her kids on a railway line, just walking on the railway line, waiting for it to happen. But then things started to open up about how destructive those and damaging the relationships were. And there was someone who was left behind, to suffer. Now, that's horribly pessimistic, but Bryony also goes to some extent to say that's one of three possibilities, all dark, but they're all possible futures if this voice that exists in the house does not get listened to. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. There is something in the house that knows how this is going to end. They don't, or they're not listening to it, and it's that part of the house which is not being addressed. That part of the relationship has not been addressed. The seller, you know, yes, they say, we'll sort it out as soon as we get back from Stockholm. That promise, we will deal with that part of our relationship. What we wanted to do was hopefully suggest there is a possibility to sort it out. Yeah, you deal with the seller. You get down there and tidy it up. then your house is complete, it's in order. But also, there is that possibility you don't, and the cellar is just the place where someone appears later, years later, and finds, you know, squashed flat on the floor, whatever the lines are, their children.
optimistic about relationships.
Well,
yes.
As someone who treats a lot of people.
Yeah,
what
I do. I feel that
relationships
can be very creative, but only from the position of there being, you know, two separate people who can have a kind of proper creative intercourse. They could never be that couple, because they weren't separate. They couldn't bear the separateness or being different from each other. So there was no possibility for a kind of creative coming together.
Within Stockholm Syndrome, something we love, the idea that within Stockholm Syndrome you assimilate with the aggressor as a survival instinct. Mm. So once that happens, you know, there's no chance for that dialogue. Quite. There's no challenge.
Yeah.
Mm. Can I just comment on that example about the photographs? Because it does seem to me I don't know who's produced the theory that explains it, but it's somebody who came out of the Beano. Because, or some, you know, two-dimensional enterprise. Because it seems to me that what's missed completely is that that when I say that's Mary and it's the enhanced one, it's an expression of my love. Totally missing from that theory. And it would be an expression of something. You know, the idea that somehow one is uninfluenced by one's emotion is daft. It's not idealization. That would be... That's Mary, which would be mad. It's that's Mary. So there.
Okay, on that note, I'd like to thank Scott, Stephen, Mary and Philip for fascinating Canadian conversations. And to remind you that there's another event coming up shortly, and I think there's some information about it with some pamphlets by the bar. Okay, well, thank you very much. You'll join me in thanking our wonderful panel.
Definitely a drink.